Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. This is the panel formerly known as the Northern Panel, now known as the Gibbons Sada Cherry Panel, since we're down here in Clark County doing Clark County cases. And our first case is case number 50549, Paul Rogers Say versus Ann Hsu, is that what it is? Ann Hsu. Mr. Kogan for the appellant, and Mr. Sterling, it will be Mr. Sterling, for respondent. Mr. Kogan, you have 15 minutes.
Good morning. I'm glad to see, Justice Cherry, that your surgery went well.
Oh, yes.
May it please the court, Jeffrey Kogan for the appellant, Paul Tsai. First issue I'd like to bring up is, did the court, and I'll call it the family court, improperly determine the resulting trust belonged to the children rather than the parent settlers? May 24th, on a motion to approve a sale of the property that's an issue, the court said it's clear that the parties intended a present and effective transfer of all the benefits of ownership, as the furthermost educational needs of the children may never reach the value of the trust corpus. Then the court went on to say that the parties have retained property rights as tenants in common in the constructive trust with the fiduciary duty to ensure that the children's educational needs are met. I'm sorry. The court, for some reason, 4 months later, basically changes that holding and decides that if there is any residual of the trust, that it belongs to the children and not to the settler trustee parents. I don't think it's disputed that a trust was formed under NRS 163. Basically, I would argue that the creation of the quitclaim deed establishes the trust. I also don't think that there's a dispute as to that the purpose of the trust was for the educational needs of the children. Ms. Hsu's or Hsu's attorney said this is an educational trust at closing argument, and now she's saying that no, that the children should get the residual, which would basically contradict the holding that the purpose and the sole purpose of the trust was an educational trust. I believe that the court, in finding that it was not an educational trust where the residual, once the children's educational needs were met, would go back to the parents, and is an error that demands reversal. The court is twisting in its findings of facts and conclusions of law her previous holding, and the California Supreme Court has said, where the findings are contradictory on material issues, and the correct determination of such issues is necessary to sustain the judgment, the inconsistency is reversible error. I believe then that as a result, that the court, this honorable court, should reverse the family court and hold that there is a resulting trust, and that if there is any residual money left over, and we're talking a lot of money, we're talking over $2 million, that a residual trust would be set up for the benefit of the settlers. This is in accord with case law in the Ninth Circuit. I didn't find any Nevada case law, which stated when a trust is for a specific purpose, it becomes a resulting trust for the benefit of the settlors when the trust purpose is accomplished. So that is what we have here. Ms. Hsu may argue that, well, the trust, the funds to purchase the property came from her. The family court decided once the properties took title as joint tenants and then deeded it to the children that it became first community property and then the property of the trust. The statement that I just gave of the Ninth Circuit is also in accord with the straight restatement of the trust second, where it basically says that the court determines, exactly says, that the court determines the trust property exceeds the amount needed for the intended purpose, and the terms of the trust do not direct the disposition. A resulting trust ordinarily is created in the settler or the settler's successors in interest.
Mr. Kogan, was there ever an issue at the trial of whether or not a gift tax was paid at the time the trust was created? I don't know what the value was at the time the property was conveyed to the the trust, you know, like that, but would there be a gift? Was that even an issue?
That was not an issue. Okay. Mr. Eccles, I believe, raised it. The property was purchased for $55,000 in 1996, and then approximately, I think, 94, I'm sorry. The complaint was filed in 96. The transfer occurred in 97. So we have a nominal, back then, we had a nominal increase in value. So certainly, and the parents could use it under their exclusion
right.
of the, now it's $3.5 million, but back then, I believe it was $600,000. So that's not an issue as to a gift tax that is required. I hope that answers
okay. Thank you.
Your question. You know, the court never even solicited testimony argument about whether it was an educational trust. Ms. Hsu may argue that because the quitclaim deed was rather sparse in its language, it didn't mention it for educational purposes. It said to Paul Tsai and, or from to Paul Tsai and Ann Hsu as trustees for the minor children, Brandon and Stacy Tsai. The document was drafted by Ann's counsel. It is noted on the document itself that when it was reported, it should be returned to Mr. Amesbury. The document was also notarized by Mr. Amesbury's paralegal. The court in May talks about education trust and then basically just says it's a trust for the benefit of children and does not give any reason for stating why the court decided to delete the education component of its order, but says that the money can only go for, at least first, for educational purposes. So we believe that that is a reversible error.
What about the jurisdiction issue?
I've got two jurisdictional issues. May 22nd, I filed a joiner in the motion to sell, but an opposition raising the jurisdictional issue of the Olson Family Trust. We have the parties to the divorce, just like Olson. I said in my opposition, the trust is an indispensable party. This court can't make an order regarding the trust without the trust being a party. Otherwise, it's not binding, which parrots, and I cited Olson, which parrots the Olson holding. I believe that the argument that the two representatives of the trustees were in court, meaning the two parties, that Ms. Hsu raises in her opposition, I don't think matters under Olson. Olson Court wrote, joinder is a party rather than the knowledge of the lawsuit, and an opportunity to intervene is the method by which potential parties are subjected to the jurisdiction of the court and bound by a judgment or decree. So we have a May 22nd opposition that says the trust is not a party, therefore the order will be void. We go all the way to October, and Ms. Hsu decides, for whatever reason, not to seek a motion to join the trust as an indispensable party. The Olson Family Trust case puts the burden on the parties to the divorce to get the trust in the litigation. Now we have something new. It was not briefed because it was not law of Nevada. And in the case of Landeth versus Malik, which came out Christmas Eve 2009, 125 Nevada 61. The court there says, and I understand it's up for rehearing, and it was a 4-3 decision, but the court said that the family court is a court of limited jurisdiction as defined by NRS 3.223. Basically, NRS 3.223 has 17 chapters that are delineated, and then some other things, such as marriage of a minor child and other things. This is a trust that is governed by Chapter 163. There is nothing in Chapter 3.23, that talks about Chapter 163.
Well, let me ask you this, because I understand your point. Under that case, is on rehearing, so we'll see what happens with that. But since there was original family court jurisdiction in the divorce between this, Mr. and Mrs. Couldn't the court exercise ancillary jurisdiction over the trust under, I think it's Borelli versus Borelli, to do that, although they couldn't exercise original jurisdiction over the trust. You couldn't go in and file a trust action in family court, but because it was part of the divorce, can they do it? And
I am, unfortunately, don't do as much family as I used to, and I don't remember Borelli. What I do remember in Landreth was they were talking about ancillary jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And there, the property would go back to the parties in their individual capacity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm arguing here the trust is an independent entity. So now it doesn't have jurisdiction over the trust because the trust is kind of out there, as opposed to in Landreth, it affected the alimony that would be received by one of the parties as a result. And there were other personal issues as opposed to third-party issues. I hope that answers.
Well, isn't this a family matter? I mean, under the statute that gives jurisdiction to the family court, it says other family matters. I mean, isn't it a family matter?
Or allows jurisdiction to rest right with the family.
I would love to see Landreth when it comes out again, and maybe I can answer that question better. Yes, it's ancillary to the family court. Frankly, before Landreth, it never even occurred to me to raise that issue. And I may have to concede that issue, but if the trust is not a part of the family court once it's formed, I believe then under the 3.223 that it's not one of those delineated issues. And while it may be ancillary, I think the more proper court would be a court of general civil jurisdiction.
So it'd be more important for somebody who does CD work and does extensive tort work to hear this case rather than a family court judge. Let's talk about what really happens in these cases.
Well, I could argue, let's throw it into the probate court. If we were saying we have the opportunity to choose our court, that would be more appropriate, certainly, than a construction defect or tort litigation. But the fact of the matter is, a district court can hear a capital murder trial, and then the next day hear a $11,000 landlord-tenant dispute. The tenant wants, again, a landlord wants to evict a tenant, and the rent is over $11,000 that's owed. So these judges are, by the Constitution, general jurisdiction judges. The family court judge, by statute, is not. So there is a probate judge that would be, if the issue was qualification of the court, let's hear it in probate. I'm going to go on to my last issue. I have 3 minutes left.
You've got 3 minutes left.
The final issue is that did Judge Elliott improperly assess to the trust the $261,000 in educational expenses for the two children while they were minor children? This is not post-secondary. This is while they were children. I believe this is an improper modification of the child support obligation. NRS 125.08090C says the court, in assessing child support, can consider the special needs, special educational needs of the children. NRS 125.14023 says you can modify child support, but it is only done prospectively. It cannot be done by retroactive modification or vacation. And this court in Day versus Day basically said the same thing here. Mr. Day wanted to start deducting his child support, I guess he had in arrears, for the college expenses that he paid for one of his children. And the court said, you can't do that. They may argue that it was always the party's intent in establishing an educational trust to pay the children's high school and junior high school needs. And there's a fact that belies that. The parties waited. Brandon was in college. Stacy was in a junior in high school before they sold the property. If the intent was to use the money to pay educational needs, one would expect at the time they needed the money before incurring $225. The other was attorney's fees and other associated costs. Before incurring a rather large expense and to educate your children, one would think they would have sold the property at least while the children were in high school. I'd like to have a minute left. If it pleases the court, I would like to use that for rebuttal.
Just note that we were at Gorman High School yesterday, and I asked what the tuition is at Gorman. It's $11,000 a year for the people who are not members of the Catholic community. So, just a side note. Yes, you can reserve the rest of that.
We'll put that on CNT.
Oh, yeah. Well, at least they did when my kid went there. I think they pay less if you're a member of the parish or whatever it is.
Okay.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Mr. Sterling, to respond.
Good morning, Your Honor. And,
you want to tell us your view on Malik?
Or not.
On Landreth?
Yeah, I call it Malik. I was one of the lucky four.
I have that problem with Beezer. Known as Shooty. I also want to mention that Mario Valencia is here also representing respondent.
Sure, welcome.
I can start with the jurisdictional issue if that's what the court would like to do. And I've looked at Landreth and at 3.223. And I think that, the court here has ancillary jurisdiction to the extent that ancillary jurisdiction is even necessary. The way I understand what happened here is to the extent there were trust issues involved, they all arose out of the divorce and the disposition of the property and the court's decision with regard to the, in essence, the support of the children with regard to education. So I think that clearly brings the trust issue within the jurisdiction of the family court. That's our position. Getting back to the top here, first of all, there's no resulting trust here. We had a complete distribution of the property from the parents to the children as a result of the quitclaim deed that arose out of the order going back to 1996, what the family court did there. And let me, the court's well aware, remind the court what the standard of review here is. This is an abuse of discretion standard. The issue here with regard to the resulting trust of the appellants, as the appellants have presented it, a resulting trust arises when the person transferring the property that does not intend that the beneficial interest in the property vest in the transferee, now either completely or partially, meaning if there's something left over that hasn't been disposed of, you have a resulting trust. And if we look at the restatement, section 404, 430, 431 of the restatement second of trust, we see that that's a question of the intent of the parties. It's a factual question. In this case, the court decided those factual issues during an evidentiary hearing on August 29, 2007. That was an extensive hearing. There was testimony. There was evidence with regard to the trust issue. It was hotly contested. The court even went back, looked at all the videotapes from the prior family court proceedings, and based on that, the court made detailed findings of fact and conclusions of law, including repeatedly stating that the intention and the effect of the quitclaim deed, based on the prior order of the court, was that the property was fully given to the children. There was no interest retained by the settlors, by Paul or Ann, with regard to the land. That's a factual question. There was evidence on both sides. There isn't any basis for disturbing that on appellate review. Any questions at this point?
No.
Okay, I'll move on. And I want to mention also, before I move on, that the court made credibility determinations that they're in those findings of fact and conclusions of law and found that Ann was credible and that Paul was not, and that in fact that he lied to the court and he fabricated at least some of his testimony. And the family court was certainly in the best position to weigh that evidence. Now the question came up as to the educational purpose of the trust. The education of the children certainly was part of the motivation of the parties when they disposed of the property by quitclaim deed to the children. But it was not made the sole purpose of the trust, and indeed wasn't even made a condition or a term of the trust. The property was given entirely to the children, but they were under 18, so the two parents were named as trustees. But it can't be said in this case that we have a resulting trust because the purpose of the trust was education, and looking at the furthermost requirements of education, the trust will be more than adequate to supply that. That's not the situation that we have here. This was a complete distribution. The appellants have argued that the findings are somehow contradictory, comparing what the court said during the March 24th, 2007 hearing and on the a motion for leave to sell property, and the later evidentiary hearing, which occurred in May, or rather in August of 2007. Two different hearings. The reason why the court had different things to say at the later hearing was that that was an evidentiary hearing where the court actually considered the evidence and heard the testimony. And if you look back at the transcript from that earlier hearing, the court makes it very clear and expressly says that this is tentative, the court's tentative thoughts or tentative rulings with regard to certain issues based on what the court is assuming the evidence to be at the time. Now, when we actually had the evidentiary hearing and all the evidence came in, that's when the court went back, looked at everything, weighed all the evidence, the testimony, the credibility of the parties, and made the decision that it did. There's nothing contradictory between those two. The first was simply preliminary thoughts of the court, which the court was entirely free to change once the evidence actually came in. We dealt with the jurisdictional issue. The question as to whether or not this was somehow a modification of the support award. This was not a modification of the support award. What we're simply dealing with here is the fact that there was trust money or trust property that was available that should have been used to pay for the education of the children, but for one reason or another was not available at the time, so Ann, the mother, paid it directly and was reimbursed from the trust property. That's not a modification of the support award. That is simply a distribution of that money for the benefit of the children pursuant to the terms of the trust. And lastly, if there was...
Now, at that time, the trust, the land hadn't been sold yet?
Right. The land
so
was...
So there was no cash to pay for the...
That's precisely right, Your Honor. There was no cash at the time. Mm-hmm. And there may have been some expenses that Ann made after that point, too, because she wasn't sure what to do with all that money that was sitting there, whether she could pay it directly for the education expenses or not. So I think there was also a period of time where she continued to make those payments. And eventually, based on documentation submitted at the evidentiary hearing or thereafter, the court went back and made an accounting all of that. Any questions? I will release the rest of my time.
Thank you. Okay, thank you. Mr. Kogan, I think you have a little over a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Minute and five.
At trial, Ann's own attorney argued to the district court, quote, it says right in the divorce decree, unquote, that the parties, quote, agree to be co-trustees and hold the property in trust for the children's education, period. The trust was set up specifically for the purpose of the education. This was something that was agreed to in front of Judge Fine. Judge Fine ordered that the property be transferred for the purposes of an educational trust. Judge Elliott does not have the right 11 years later to modify that when Judge Fine was the one closer to the time Judge Elliott had to review. Yes, it was fully given. All the property was given to the trust. But I disagree with my esteemed colleague because the purpose was for the children's education. Once that education requirement is met, the resulting trust arises. So yes, it was a full conveyance, but with a specific purpose that I believe is a reservation of the rights. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to Mr. Kogan and Mr. Sterling for their arguments and briefs in this matter. This matter involving either a family and our trust case will stand submitted.